All right, good morning. I'm calling the meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy to order. Today is Thursday, March 14, 2024. Time is now 10:17. We are joined today by Representative Armstrong, Representative Schrage, Representative McKay, Representative Prox, Representative Wright, Representative Baker, myself, Chair Rauscher, and we do have a quorum. I would like to thank our House Record Secretary, Cale Brown, and the LIO moderator, Zach Hawthorne, Zach Lawhorn, and my committee aide, Craig Valdez, for all they do for this committee. So before we begin, I'd like to remind everybody and the members in the audience to silence their cell phones, any electronics that they have, and if anybody has a need to pass a note to or from committee members, please get a hold of my committee aide, Craig Valdez. So today, our schedule, we're going to bring back HB 368. Last time we heard this was March 7th, last Thursday. This is the fourth time we've heard this bill. Today we will hear before that from Steve Colt, Research Professor of Energy, Economics, Policy, and he will walk us through his analysis of HB 368, Clean Energy, Electricity Generation, and Clean Energy Tax Credits. Following that, we will work on two amendments, Amendment 1 and H8, which is Amendment 2. So, also, I just want to remind everybody that at 10:15, we have a hard stop, because we're going to be going to the floor, and then we will have a brief recess at that time. Call the chair whenever floor session's over. It's my intention to reconvene here at 1, or 10 minutes after floor session ends, and continue to work as we started today. So Steve Colt is on the phone with us now. Mr. Colt, can you hear us, and are you ready to go over your analysis?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I can hear you, and can you hear me?
Good. Mr. Cope, please put your name on record for the committee and give us your affiliation and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve Colt, C-O-L-T. I am a research professor with the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, ACEP, at University of Alaska Fairbanks. And I will try to pause often to allow for questions as we go. If I don't pause, feel free, obviously, to speak and interrupt me. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me in your meeting today. I'm here to present a little bit of what we really is glorified arithmetic, in an attempt to see what kinds of quantities are we talking about that might be generated. Actually, that was an unintended pun. Quantities of both electricity and tax credits that might come out of this bill using some projections that we at ACEP have made for future electricity sales, which is really the basis of generating the tax credit. So I'd like to proceed to my slide number 2, which restates a little more clearly what I just said. I'm able to address really two questions with some measure of detail and confidence. The first one relates to electricity. How much clean energy, as defined by HB 368, would be brought into service if our utilities were to meet the clean energy standard, and if they started on the timeline right after 2026. And the second question that I'm able to shed some light on is more arithmetic, namely how much quantity of tax credits in dollars might be created under this same scenario. I also have tried to just put some numbers together related to a question that was given to me by staff relating to how big of a player are schools in this electricity scene, and if they were to become generators or anchor purchasers of power, how much power might we be talking about in that realm? And I have a little bit to say about that. So I'll proceed to slide 3, and I'll also pause a little bit. Okay, hearing no questions, slide 3 basically gives the what I've labeled the quick answer to the question of how much clean electricity might we expect to see as a result of our utilities meeting the standard, which is best described, I would say, as the 35% of sales by 10 years and 60% of sales by 25 years after the clock starts. And as you know, the clock only starts when a sufficient transmission network is in place, at least under the version that I've been working off of. So I just started the clock in 2027. It's an admittedly optimistic starting time, but it works for showing the general pattern of what we might expect. And this graph, there's several elements here, but I'd like to just direct your attention to the gold section, because there are really two sort of magic numbers that you get from crunching all this data about how much electricity might be generated in total to meet demand. And then you can start asking, well, how much is 35% of that? How much is 60% of that? How much would result from the specific efforts to meet the clean energy standards? And so what I ended up coming away with after all this number crunching was really two magic numbers. And they are, here are the two magic numbers. This is really the big takeaway, I think. On the rail belt, if our utilities followed the CES or achieved the CES, and if demand grows the way that we at ASEP think it certainly could, which would be a good thing for consumers because we would spread fixed costs over more sales. So this would be a welcome event. But if these things happen, we're going to get out of the CES process 4 million megawatt hours of new clean electricity. And we're also going to get 500,000 megawatt hours from what I have classified as our PCE communities, because I had to make a classification that we have data for. So that's a kind of a proxy for rural Alaska. And I'll just leave it at that. Those are like the two magic numbers that sort of, to me, define the scope and magnitude of this bill, and everything else comes from them. Another thing in this figure, and then we'll go on to sort of back up and walk through how we got here. But another thing in this figure that is, I guess, noteworthy is that we already have a significant amount of clean energy as defined by this bill. And that's in the light blue in this figure. And so there is no, even if we declared the transmission network adequate tomorrow or at the end of 2025, there would be no immediate crisis, if you will, to comply with the 35% as laid out in this bill. There would be still be plenty of lead time. I'd like to proceed to slide 4, and I'll pause if there are any questions.
Seeing none, right. Please continue.
Here's the quick answer to my second question that I posed about how much money are we talking about for the clean energy tax credit. And this is relatively very simple arithmetic once you have the megawatt hours figured out going into the future. So I'll just state it, make sure it gets clearly on the record. At a tax credit of 0.2 cents per kilowatt hour, which is the same as $2 per megawatt hour, multiplying by 1,000, you would be generating, or the state would be issuing, tax credits of about $5 to $6 million per year by the time we get out to 2050. And the credits wouldn't even start, according to this scenario that I'll show you more of as we go here. They wouldn't even start for several years. And that's because, as I said in the previous slide, there would be no immediate crisis. People might deploy clean energy right away, but they wouldn't have to. So that's the short answer to how much tax credits we would get. And what I'll do next is just give a little bit more backup on the assumptions that are driving these results. So let's move to, I shouldn't move to slide 5 until I pause first and ask and see if there are any questions. If not, we'll move to slide 5.
Yes, we do have a question from Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, what I'm seeing here is 65 million cumulative tax credits paid out over give or take 20 years. So call it $3 million per year. My question is, this seems like a relatively small amount compared to the capital investment that would be required to achieve the $2 per megawatt hour. Seems like a relatively small amount compared to the total capital investment. So I'm wondering how much incentive that would create. And we're not going to get that exact, but does that seem like it's a significant thing, a significant incentive?
Through the chair, Mr. Culp, you have an answer to the question there.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Pax. I don't have a good answer, but I've been thinking about it. And later on in this slide deck, pretty quickly, we'll see, and again, it's really just arithmetic, that if you could consider, say, 10 times this amount, 2 cents per kilowatt hour. And I have also been, I believe, informed by staff that there may be some thinking or an amendment that might offer 5 cents per kilowatt hour for a limited time, which would be $50 per megawatt hour. So I did a little scribbling trying to think about that amount. What would that do in terms of incentives? And here's a little back of the envelope that I can offer you for what it's worth. When you get in the realm of five 5 cents per kilowatt hour. Let's leave 2 cents aside. 5 cents per kilowatt hour is roughly, it's right in the ballpark with how much it costs Dugatch Electric to generate another little bit of electricity with natural gas at today's prices. So you would be talking about an incentive that almost, is almost equal to what they're paying for gas-fired power to generate some more. And I think that would have to have a major effect on the economics of, for example, the economics of Chugach purchasing a whole bunch more wind power. They could, you can start to do this in your head. They could buy it for 11 cents, get 5 cents of tax credit, and be able to sell it to us ratepayers at something that's now less than what they're paying for gas now.
Right.
If gas prices go up, that would become even more attractive. So to make a long story short, one can almost reason backwards and say that 0.2 cents per kilowatt hour is probably not going to have a dramatic incentive effect. But if you were to go with something much more aggressive, like 5 cents, I think that would really, that would have to sway the calculations that at least that Chugach, my utility, would be making.
Okay. Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, please continue, Mr. Cole, with your presentation.
All right, let's go to slide 5. I think we can actually speed up here. These slides just provide a little bit of backup for the record and to help people understand where the numbers are coming from in case you find the assumptions unpalatable. You could think about what alternative assumptions might be. And I've also produced a few sensitivity cases looking at a few different versions of the numbers. So on slide 6, we don't need to go through this. It's just a little bit of backup for why ACEP has electric load projections that show that the rail belt could well see a doubling of electric sales by 2050. And for non-rail belt places, we really have not, unfortunately, we have not had occasion to dive into a detailed projection the way we did for the rail belt. So I have just assumed, I made some assumptions that seem reasonable about how the electric load might increase outside the rail belt. And I think I really just need to leave it at that. It's not quite doubling, but there could be significant growth outside the rail belt as well. Hearing no questions, I'll go quickly through slide 7. Slide 7 is just a picture of all those assumptions, and it shows the electric sales projections in all their glory. And you can see the yellow wedge showing that a major, or probably the major contributor to growth in the rail belt, if we have it, it will most likely come from electric vehicles and heat pumps. If we don't have any, if for some reason we have no electric vehicles and no heat pumps, our load will probably be almost flat in the rail belt and probably in other places too. So that's the driver of this increase in load. Moving on to slide 8. This is just a little catalog of what I just tallied up, what we already have that would meet the definition of clean energy as defined by HB 368. So it's all of your coal, hydro, wind, and solar. And this slide just documents those numbers for the record. I did the same exercise on slide 9 for PCE communities where we have a good data set and cataloged what we already have in the way of clean energy in the PCE places. And you'll see a picture of that later, so we don't need to dwell on it. I'll just pause really quickly and then we'll go on to slide 10. And slide 10, I apologize for naming the rest of the state in this way. Most of the energy is really hydropower in Southeast. And that's why this region, if you lump all the rest of the data into this bucket, they've already met the clean energy standard essentially and wouldn't really have to do anything to meet it, as we'll see in a picture later.
Nice.
All right, slide 11 just recapitulates what we already saw earlier, that for this analysis, I started the clock in 2027, which is admittedly optimistic, and I created a sort of smooth pathway. It's the opposite of a glide path. It's a takeoff path, really, for how you would have to deploy clean energy if you wanted to have a smooth path and meet the target. And that was shown in the graph earlier, and you'll see it again. Let's move on to slide 12, and we're getting reasonably close to getting through this. The idea of slide 12 is just to show the task that would be faced by our utilities if they were to set out to meet the clean energy standard and to hit 35% by 2036 and to hit 60% by 2051. So the point of this graph is to say, look, here's what we need to do. That's the black line. And we've already got a head start, as it were, with our existing renewables. That's the light blue. And we're going to get some sort of free help, if you will, from customer-sided solar. At least ACEP projects that this is going to happen. So what the utilities will be faced with is filling in the white triangle to get up to that black line and meet the targets. So that's sort of the task before them that would emerge. And that's the purpose of this picture. Going on to slide 13, we're now almost full circle, coming back to the picture that we saw early at the beginning with the quick answer. The only, interesting thing worth pointing out here that's sort of new is, actually there's two things that are interesting to me. But one is it is possible to calculate easily and to show here in green the effect of the new projects are only get the tax credit for 10 years and then they age out of tax credit eligibility and they go from being gold to being green. And so that is helps to limit the extent of the money going out the door for tax credits. So that's somewhat interesting, the distinction between the gold and the green. Another thing that you might find interesting, although maybe not, is the fact that you might ask, why is the gold down at the 35% marker? Why is the gold line above the necessary black line? And the answer is that I'm assuming that the standard would have to be met essentially within each region, or really by each load serving entity. And you don't get to call up your friends in Southeast Alaska and say, can I count your hydro towards my CES obligations? Now, of course, you could write the bill that way, but I'm interpreting it that the bill is not written that way. And so you have this basically rail belt deploying stuff that they need to meet the CES. And when you add it all up, the whole state would be actually exceeding it for this, whenever this orange color is above the black line.
So Mr. Cole, let me ask you a question. So even though the bill calls for most of what's going on to take place after the transmission line is built is when the accountability starts, you see this actually moving ahead because of the credits that they will receive in lieu of meeting certain target dates, and they will try to attain them early. Is that what you're saying here?
Mr. Chair, not exactly, although that's a very good question, and I would like to answer it. But this little this interesting, I found it an interesting sort of result when I plotted this stuff. The fact that you see the orange above the black is that it reflects the fact that the rail belt would have to put in a lot of new stuff, whereas in Southeast, they actually they're in surplus relative to hitting 35% because they've got so much hydro.
Okay, please continue.
Yeah, I think I will continue. I thought your question, though, about would they start early is an excellent question, and I'm going to get to that in at the end of the slide deck.
Okay, one thing we have a problem this meeting. We are all going to the floor at 11 o'clock, which never usually happens on a Thursday or Tuesday, though I have to say it happens more often lately than I've ever seen it happen. So we're going to have to we're going to pause here. I'm going to go to a brief at ease. Thank you. I have a question. Since we are running short on time today because of the floor session that moved into the middle of our committee meeting here today, I was wondering, can you finish your presentation later on at 1 o'clock today?
Yes, Mr. Chair, absolutely.
Well, I really, really appreciate it, and I do sincerely apologize for having to ask you that, but I'm making a lot of apologies today because of our schedule. So right now, I would like to entertain amendments on this on the bill that we're talking about, which is the CES, and Mr. Representative McKay, do you have a motion?
I'm amendment two.
I'm going to move yours right now if you'd like to move it.
Briefly.
Yeah. Briefly. Okay, we are back on record. At this moment, we are going to recess to the call of the chair, and whenever that may be. This is the House Special Energy Committee, and we are back on record. We were in the middle of a presentation, and the presentation, I'm sorry, and the presentation is basically on the CES. It is being given by Mr. Cole. Mr. Cole, are you still online?
Brief at ease.
Brief at ease. All right, we're back on record here in House Special Energy Committee, and we are going to be ending the presentation with Steve Colt here. He's halfway through it. Steve Colt, can you hear me online?
Yes, I can, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Colt, are you prepared to finish your presentation?
Yes, I am. Shall I proceed?
Yes, please put your name on record again and proceed with your presentation.
My name is Steve Colt, C-O-L-T. I'm a research professor with the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. When we adjourned, or when we paused my presentation, I believe we were finishing up with slide 13. And I think I think we can go on to slide 14. Let me just ask you, Mr. Chair, if you're back with me on 14.
We are with you on slide 14. It's on the screen right now, and everybody has their deck slant open.
Thank you. So at 14, we are back where we started. With the conclusion that with a tax credit of 0.2 cents per kilowatt hour and our utilities meeting the CES but not exceeding it and starting the clock in 2027, we have this result of paying out or generating about $5 to $6 million of tax credit, and it accumulates to $65 million. So we've already seen this. Now, I just want to share a couple more results that can be called sensitivity cases, and then I'll be wrapped up with my presentation per se. So on to slide 15. It's very easy to do the sensitivity case where the credit is 2 cents instead of 0.2. Everything just gets an extra zero multiplied by 10. And so now the payout or the tax credit amounts would be up at $55 million per year, accumulating to $600 million. So that's a really very simple arithmetic. But as we get into 2 cents per kilowatt hour, I think it may be helpful for the committee to for context to point out or reiterate that when you get into the 2 to 3 cents per kilowatt hour zone, you're basically at the level that the feds would reimburse or would subsidize or would offer tax credits for those clean energy developers who were able and chose to take advantage of the federal production tax credit under the Inflation Reduction Act. So this is the ballpark that the feds are operating in with the IRA credits. I believe that if you meet the labor apprenticeship requirements and you choose to take this production tax credit instead of taking an investment tax credit, you can get between 2 and 3 cents per kilowatt hour as your IRA federal credit. So for what it's worth, that's the ballpark that we're in, that the feds are in, is in the 2 to 3 cent zone here. I'll pause here before going on to 16.
Yeah, Mr. Colt, I have a question from Representative Shragi through the chair.
Thank you, Chair Rauscher, and through the chair. Just to make sure I'm understanding correctly, you said the 2 cents per kilowatt hour is what the federal incentive is, and I think that lasts through 2032 maybe. Is that correct? And then Are we modeling this just so that folks can get an understanding as to the credit available through the federal incentive, or is this to model? I think Amendment Number 8 takes it from 0.2 cents potentially to from 0.2 cents to 2 cents. So is this slide 15 to outline the federal incentive available to utilities, or is it to outline the cost of Amendment Number 8 passing potentially?
This, through the chair, Representative Shragi, this slide was intended just to do the math on 2 cents per kilowatt hour. I wasn't aware of what specific amendment might invoke this number, but I was asked if I could just give the results for 2 cents. So that's the spirit in which it was done. And it just really occurred to me right now in passing that it might be helpful context for you folks to sort of remember or be reminded, or I reminded myself anyway, that, gee, 2 cents kind of in the ballpark that the feds are offering through the IRA.
Follow up, if I may, Chair Rauscher.
Follow up, Representative.
Yeah, thank you, and trying to be quick about this through the chair. So 2 cents is just because that was what was asked to be modeled, but you're telling me that that does actually reflect what the federal incentive is. And then can you confirm that that is what the federal incentive is? And then the second part of the question would be, do you know when that federal incentive, that program ends? Does that tax credit end in 2032? Like I, for some reason, think that it does.
Mr. Cole, through the chair, you have a response?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Shragi, thank you for that good question. The answer to the first part is that I checked the IRA web pages. There seem to be several of them this morning, and the number that I was seeing, if you meet all of the labor and apprenticeship requirements, and again, if you choose to take the IRA credit as a production tax credit, which then displaces your ability to take the investment tax credit. That's an important caveat, I think. But at any rate, the number I was seeing was 2.75 cents. And it does end in, I believe you are correct, 2032. But there's a extension clause in the IRA which says that if the United States has not reduced its carbon emissions in the power sector by, I believe, 75%, then the credits will continue. And I know that my colleagues and I at ASEP, we chose to model the credit as continuing when we did recent work, because we feel that it's actually unlikely that the United States will meet that 75% reduction by 2032.
Thank you very much.
I may not have answered all of your questions, but hopefully.
Yeah, that was very helpful. Thank you very much, and thank you, Chair Rauscher.
Mr. Colt, how you doing? There was a this Representative Rauscher. The there was an earlier question that pertained to the transmission lines and when they will be completed. The CES, as it responds to the completion of those lines, and the power producers or the utility companies getting a head start because of some of the tax credits and incentives, will they make a difference in the numbers as we look at the future on how this all plays out?
Yes, and I did consider that in a little more detail. I don't have a slide for it because I considered it after the 24-hour cutoff, but I'm going to speak to that very briefly in about 2 slides.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Then please continue.
All right. Let's land this plane. Slide 16 illustrates another case that I was asked to run, and I hope I interpreted it correctly, but here we have the 2 cents for across the board, plus 1 cent for a bonus for some definition of rural places, perhaps off the road places, perhaps in fact the way that I corralled the data, just because it's really the only way to do it. These little blue blocks on slide 16 show what would happen if you added a 1 cent per kilowatt hour bonus to all the PCE utility generation that is clean, of course. So I think it's a pretty good proxy for any reasonable definition of rural or off-road. And anyway, there it is. It's a very modest addition in the grand scheme of things to this 2 cent scenario.
Seeing no questions, please continue.
All right. And now we're really going to skip slide 17 because I misinterpreted what I believe one of the amendments actually says. I apologize for that. I'm going to speak to it. But this slide actually shows what it says. 5 cents for the first 5 years of the project's life, and then declining to zero. And I now understand that I believe the intent or the actual amendment before you is 5 cents for 4 or 5 calendar years. So this slide really should go in the dustbin, but there it is. If there are no questions, or if that made sense, I'll just be able to close with some thoughts about the chair's question about what would happen about accelerating the timetable.
Mr. Colt, since you asked for other questions, Representative McKay has a question that he'd like to ask you at this moment.
Yeah, Mr. Colt, thank you very much for your presentation. I guess I'm a simple man, and I need to put this in simple terms. Looks like we're going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars in tax credits, according to your graphs. How many windmills does that represent across the state of Alaska? And how much will that reduce the global temperature?
Through the chair, Representative McKay, that's an excellent question. I can answer the first part of it by reference to, let me just put on the screen here, slide 21. I could have gone back to slide 2, I guess, but it was faster to go to 21, which shows the picture that allows me to try to answer the first part of your question. So looking at 21, which is the rail belt only, and again, the calculation, I think the main point that I'm offering as a takeaway is that under reasonable assumptions, we would see 4 million megawatt hours of clean energy as defined by this bill, which could include coal, therefore. But if it were all wind, 4 million megawatt hours of wind, and I can't do the math in my head, but I believe it would be something like, I'm just pausing because I did do one back of the envelope. Something like 6 or 7 or 8 major wind projects of the size that is being proposed, for example, at Shovel Creek, which is a 200 to 250 megawatt project. So,
follow up. Just
kind of doing the math on the fly here. I hope I get it right. But if you put in, well, it's actually more than that. It would be 10 to 12 Shovel Creek size wind projects if it was all done with wind. And then turning to the second part of your question, how much would that reduce the global temperature? I cannot do that math, alas.
Mr. Colt, there's going to be a follow-up question, but I do want to remind Representative McKay, we're talking about coal, gas, hydro, micro reactors, blue hydrogen, green hydrogen, and the like, which will fill in that it just won't be completely made up of solar and windmills. But you can go ahead with your follow-up question.
Quick follow-up. How many windmills are at Shovel Creek, Mr. Cole, do you know?
I'm not a wind tech expert, but I did check the installed capacity that's proposed. And the proposed installed capacity, according to the DNR filing, is 260 megawatts of wind.
Okay. Well, all right. Thank you very much. Thank you, Chairman.
You bet. Mr. Colt, please continue. Representative Prox has a question.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Colt. Or thank you, Mr. Chairman, through the chair. Mr. Colt, do these calculations consider any elasticity of either demand for electricity or supply of the electricity? They seemed, the first view at any rate, seemed to have more or less the same shape, just difference in magnitude, just simple arithmetic. But does this take into account any change in the demand or supply, encourage more supply?
Through the chair, Representative Prax, that's a great question. And the short answer is no, but I think that behind the curtain, if you will, there is an assumption that I'm not going to skip through the slides on the screen, but if you look back somewhere around 8 or 9 or 10, there's a clear picture showing a yellow wedge of new loads coming onto the system in the form of electric vehicles and heat pumps. And wearing my economist hat, I believe that in order to get that kind of new load on the system, we are going to have to pay attention to elasticity and do something to have favorable rates for those uses, perhaps, you know, off-peak rates or other ones that benefit the consumer, bring the load on, and benefit all the other ratepayers by helping to spread the cost over more load. That's my answer to your question. But another short answer, and then I'm done, is that we're not using a full-blown econometric model that tries to directly measure price elasticity effect.
Okay. Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, please continue, Mr. Colt, with your presentation.
All right. I'm going to leave 21. Well, it's on my screen anyway. It's a sort of a good summary of what we've been through today. I did want to speak just and the slides after 21 are simply backup so that the record can be reasonably complete. But I did want to speak very briefly to the potential effects of, I believe it's Amendment 9. I might have the number wrong, but the idea would be to have a very, let's call it, robust credit of 5 cents per kilowatt hour for 4 or 5 calendar years. And what might that do? So I already talked, I think, this morning about how 5 cents per kilowatt hour could really move the needle on turning a project that is not economic for today's ratepayers into one that is immediately economic for today's ratepayers. So it could be a pretty powerful incentive. And if the only way that I could see to try to take this calculation one more step was to look at or just consider two projects that are more or less, well, they're not on the books, but they've been announced as what we might call aspirational projects. And so if we look at Shovel Creek, for example, I looked it up that it's about or it's greater than 200 megawatts. And 200 megawatts is the capacity, but it's pretty easy to calculate that would generate about 700,000 megawatt hours of energy. And if you applied the 5-cent credit to that, you would be looking at $35 million a year of state tax credit to Shovel Creek. And I just thought that was interesting because it indicates the magnitude of what would be going on just for that one project with respect to how much tax credit money would be flowing. And then I did one other example, and then I'll be done. The other example was Chugach Electric. My utility has announced it has a very near-term goal of acquiring 100,000 megawatt hours of energy by 2025. And if you just run that through the math at 5 cents a kilowatt hour, which is $50 a megawatt hour, you get that Chugach would get a reward of $5 million per year of tax credit for however long you chose to leave it in place. They would get that kind of a reward for carrying out that or meeting that goal, which is on the books right now as an internal goal. And it seems to me that would be a substantial reward that I, as a ratepayer, would certainly love to receive. So those two examples may help give you some context for the kind of fiscal impact that there would be if there was a big uptake. And I use two projects that are not necessarily on the books, but they're expressed as hopefully on the books. And then the big question would be, with this kind of tax credit on the table, how much more would you get that would into the ring so they could get this 5 cents before it expired? Sorry that was a little bit long-winded. I think I'm done with what we could call my presentation, and I'm happy to entertain further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Colt. I'm looking for hands that may be raised with a question. And you did an absolutely fabulous job of presenting your slide deck that I believe there are a few questions left. They did ask questions all through. Representative Shragi had to leave. Representative McKay is on his way. So due to leather scheduling. But we do want to thank you for your time. We want to thank you for the presentation. It was extremely valuable in light of the amendments that are going to be brought in. And I think everybody got an education on how they all affect or may not affect positively the amendments. So I'm going to let you go. Thank you very much for your time. We appreciate the fact that you were able to wait us out while we were on the House floor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, have a great day.
Honor to be with you.
Thank you. So, so seeing no other work in front of us, the amendments we're going to be taking up on Tuesday's meeting at 10:15. Hopefully, there won't be a floor session or a U.S. senator speaking, or a joint House session, or something else that might take its place. In light of the fact that that may not happen, we will have amendments on Tuesday coming, and the date is the 18th? 19th. All right. And seeing no other business, I'm going to adjourn this meeting at 1:58.